Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And, well, we've got two rock music legends. If you're a child of the 80s, you can't forget The Cars' Magic. And then Eddie Money, too.
I know. Eddie Money died.
Rick Ocasek, Cars frontman, dead at the age of 75.
Well, they were saying, CBS News this morning was saying, there's reports, multiple reports of how old he was, but he was anywhere between 72 to 75 years old. So lie low, fellas, if you're going to lie, you know.
And Eddie Money at 70 last week. So, you know, you'll feel it. Bumper music, Cars bumper music. Maybe we'll get a little Two Tickets to Paradise and a couple of Eddie Money songs in this morning as well.
And what is your favorite Cars song and your favorite Eddie Money song? You can text us anytime, 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. What was yours, Dan?
I prefer to say what is the best Eddie Money song, what is the best
Cars
song, because it's not like it's subjective.
Oh, right.
These are just objective facts, what the best songs are.
I like Take Me Home Tonight. That's his comeback song, you know, after he took some time off, then he was back on the scene. It just magically appears, man.
Yeah.
But he announced that's 7 weeks ago that he had esophageal.
With Ronnie Spector.
Yeah, that he had esophageal cancer, and he went fast.
All right, well, we'll be splicing those in, so yeah, if you can call in with your instant request, sure, we'll spin some records here, why not? Also, we've got a new kicker for the Bears. Eddie Pinheiro.
He delivered.
Solidified his slot. Woo! That was quite the game, quite the last minute yesterday. Now we just apparently
we
need a quarterback.
Quarterback. Yeah. The minor details.
Although, again, he made the critical throw that set up the winning field goal. So there's still flashes of Trubisky.
Possibility?
It's just difficult to watch that when you think, gosh, what would the Bears be with Deshaun Watson or Patrick Mahomes?
Oh, yeah.
Both drafted after Trubisky. Anyway, all right, we'll talk a little bit about that later. But we got a lot of big stories that happened over the weekend, including this one, Brett Kavanaugh. I don't want to say there's a new allegation because there really isn't. There's a new book coming from the left about Brett Kavanaugh that contains an uncorroborated allegation that wasn't even embraced by the alleged victim. This story, nicely summed up by Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino, who you've had on the show. They're the co-authors of the book Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation, The Future of the Supreme Court. They'll be at our Freedom Fest next month. And Molly Hemingway and Carrie Severino were on with Tom Bevin, RealClearPolitics.com, trying to break this down to understand just how reckless it is for many of the leading Democrat POTUS socialist candidates for president, the socialist candidates for POTUS, I should say. You're having all of them running around this weekend talking about a Kavanaugh impeachment now, as if they aren't also focused on the Trump impeachment. You know, this is impeach everybody. I get it. Molly Hemingway explaining the nature of the allegation in this book by a couple of New York Times reporters forthcoming that was excerpted over the weekend and created a firestorm inside the Beltway.
Yes. So there is this book coming out on Tuesday. It's written by two reporters who were actually kind of involved in anti-Kavanaugh efforts, is probably the best way to put it. They were reporting on it for the New York Times. They were pulled off of their beats to help because they both had backgrounds, privileged backgrounds, where they had intersected with people who were in the story. And Robin Pogorbin went to Yale with Kavanaugh. She actually roomed with one of the central figures who coordinated anti-Kavanaugh efforts. She lightly discloses that in her book. And now they're out with a book, and Carrie and I have been reading it. I just finished it. And they also have an essay where they claim that there was another allegation. Left out of the essay is that the claim that was made is actually denied by the alleged victim. They put that in their book, but they didn't put that in their essay, which is causing some people to question their journalistic ethics.
And Carrie Severino broke it down even further.
So what they really have is two Senate staffers who say that Steyer told them that he heard from a woman that at a party, where everyone was maybe drunk, Kavanaugh's friends pushed him and his genitalia into her. Now, what's crazy is that the story itself is, I mean, if you even followed that, that's impressive. It's so many links in the chain. And the part that they leave out is that this woman apparently has told her friends that she doesn't even remember it. And Steyer himself and the woman are not speaking to Pogorbin and Kelly. So this is it's not even like third hand, fourth hand count of an incident that, even if it happened as it is described, sounds like it was Kavanaugh's friends who were the wrongdoers here. So it is a very bizarre thing to try to hang your hat on as a new allegation.
And the New York Times added an editor's note to this excerpt from the forthcoming book about Kavanaugh by their two reporters after the firestorm. An earlier version of this article, which was adapted from a forthcoming book, did not include one element of the book's account regarding an assertion by a Yale classmate that friends of Brett Kavanaugh pushed his penis into the hand of a female student at a drunken dorm party. The book reports that the female student declined to be interviewed, and friends say that she does not recall the incident. That information has been added to the article.
Minor detail.
Exactly.
It's ridiculous. Because we heard about this woman during the Kavanaugh hearing. The FBI contacted her attorney, this Ramirez's attorney, and said...
No. This is another allegation. This is not Deborah Ramirez.
This is an addition
to Deborah Ramirez. A classmate, Max Steyer, you just heard Carrie Severino mention, is the one who is said to have seen Kavanaugh pull his pants down at a different drunken dorm party where friends pushed his genitalia. And by the way, when is Kavanaugh's genitalia going to be a Twitter handle? Or is it already? I don't know. Pushed his penis into the hand of a female student. Steyer runs a nonprofit in D.C., notifies senators and the FBI about this account, according to these two New York Times reporters. But the FBI did not investigate. Steyer has declined to discuss it publicly. They say they corroborated the story with two officials who've communicated with Steyer. Which part of the story? The story they reported to the FBI or corroborating the actual story, the actual allegation? The female student declined to be interviewed. Friends say she doesn't recall the episode. That was added after the original story was published and after you had all of these presidential contenders, Castro and Bobby O and Reparation H, all of them call for Kavanaugh to be impeached. They're calling for him to be impeached on another allegation that's reminiscent of Deborah Ramirez's allegation. But this allegation isn't even recalled by alleged victim. And it's like a game of telephone, as you heard Carrie Severino describing, among former Yale classmates at the time.
Well, who remembers a drunken party, dorm party from 30 years ago? 30 years ago, 30 plus years.
Well, not the alleged victim. That's one who doesn't remember it.
A rag newspaper with reporters who are irresponsible, and they wrote a book just to make money. And it's like, if they can't impeach Trump now, let's impeach his Supreme Court justice nominees. Let's go after Brett Kavanaugh.
I'll tell you, it's remarkable.
Again, I don't want to. It's like the same movie seen twice, and the first time it ended well, and the second time it's going to end well. But just leave him alone. And I think about his wife and his kids. Just enough already. They have to relive this hell again.
Even in, even with the questionable assertions of Blase Ford and Deborah Ramirez, at least you had somebody come forward and there was something to discuss. and something to inquire after. This is what exactly?
It's defamation of character is what this is.
And the reporting by the New York Times, I mean, Andrew Sullivan, writing in New York Magazine, ironically, the New York Times has moved from liberalism to activism. That's generous. I mean, they announced they were doing it, and they've sort of re-announced it a couple of times, most recently with Dean Baquette's big editorial board meeting, where he said, you know, we're moving from Russia to racism. Fine. But, I mean, do you... the lack of restraint, the lack of interest in the facts, anything resembling journalistic ethics. Again, this is supposed to be the standard bearer for journalism in the West.
I love what President Trump tweeted. Brett Kavanaugh should start suing people for libel, or the Justice Department should come to his rescue. The lies being told about him are unbelievable. False accusations without recrimination. When does it stop? They're trying to influence his opinions. Can't let this happen.
And then you have these unhinged socialist candidates for president talking about he needs to be impeached. Julian Castro, Mitch McConnell stole two Supreme Court seats. What stole? What are you talking about? That was the president was elected. Then there were vacancies. Then he nominated an individual. Then he nominated another individual after another vacancy.
Yeah,
then there
was a stealing,
Senate confirmation hearing.
Oh, stealing.
Are you a legislator? You're a former cabinet level official, Julian Castro. This is a joke. And by the way, for all of those who put their pea hats on and were ready to string Kavanaugh up in the public square, how are you feeling about it now? And as Severino and Hemingway write in their book, and basically that was the impetus for their book, and what's going to be next for the next nominee?
Oh, God.
Spirit of due process. I mean, you think this is treating people fairly?
Again, I think of his wife and his young daughters and...
Forget...
No, no.
I mean, the family's fine.
They have to relive this hell again.
Yeah, the family's fine. But how about due process for the individual in question? This is the bedrock of a free society, if you're going to have any belief in equal justice under the law. And this isn't technically a legal matter, but it's a social moray that should inform these sorts of inquiries. And it's completely absent. And those who like to talk about criminal justice reform are happy to wave away due process, that ethos, when it comes to political opponents. That should frighten you. Tom in Deer Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Oh, hi. Good morning. I wanted to discuss this on a local angle. Thought maybe I'd call up and talk about the time the Cars played Poplar Creek and it rained 4 inches and turned it into a giant water slide and how much fun we had. But that's not how I am. Let's get down to brass tacks.
All right.
I want to talk about my congressman, Sean Kasten,
yes,
that tweeted out yesterday to the effect of what a liar, that Kavanaugh is in the majority of the U.S. Senate and believe that. And then, of course, he got a subtweet from one of our local famed journalists, Eric Zorn. Another guy piled on, Rex Hupke. So it's a narrative. They don't care what the facts, what the truths are. They don't want to have fun or talk about music. They want to lie about this. In my opinion, they want to lie about this because of abortion. That's my opinion.
Thanks for the call, Tom.
Listen to podcasts of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy are playing the best of Eddie Money, the best of the Cars all morning. I know Rick Ocasek was the front man.
Yeah.
And he's passed, rest in peace. But he wasn't their best vocalist for my money.
Who?
Benjamin Orr. Yeah. Who did the Cars' best song, Mike Scott.
Oh, you two cats were discussing this during the break.
He announced what he said was the Cars' best
song.
That's
right.
All right.
Which was what, Mike?
Bye Bye Love.
Exactly.
From 1978.
That's not it.
I can agree with you. I love the song.
Yeah, it's good. It's a good song. There's so many good songs.
Yeah.
Oh,
but
I'm definitely
going to I think I know where you're going, and I think you're right.
First of all, oh, really?
Yeah, I do. No, I hadn't even considered that song, but I think you're right.
All right, what's
the best car song? Drive.
Yeah.
Come on, sing it. Nothing wrong.
That's a song. Who's gonna drive you home? And I don't think you can really select a car song pre Paulina Poroskova. I think you have to think about the cars with Ocasek married to Poroskova. Okay. Who is, by the way, in that video?
In that video, directed by whom?
Oh, I don't know.
Timothy Hutton.
Oh, really?
Oh,
yes.
Wow. That's a deep dig.
Deep dive.
That's
We're talking
a deep dig.
Vinyl disc special this morning.
You know, the Cars made a bunch of great videos. They were one of the reasons they were so popular in the 80s.
Because of their videos.
Yeah, they made great
no
videos.
Doubt.
On MTV, remember?
Yeah, you might
or
think.
Or Friday Night Videos, you'd stay up late to watch them.
Oh, yeah, I don't remember Friday Night Videos, but you again, you're many years my senior.
But he died in his home in New York from natural causes.
Yeah, found in Manhattan in his townhouse or whatever. All right, so we'll continue to take your suggestions, but now you have the correct answer that you can share with your friends in terms of the best car song.
Okay.
Now you have a better understanding of cars, and you know who directed Drive.
I'm going to download the best of.
Timothy Hutton really topped out early. He had Terms of Endearment. Mm-hmm. And then he had this video.
Ordinary People,
ordinary
right?
People.
Oh, I mean, sorry.
Ordinary people, right?
Ordinary People.
You could be right. Check me. I think it was Ordinary People.
It was Ordinary People.
Ordinary People.
He was the brother who lived.
Ordinary People.
I just watched that movie again.
Yes, thank you.
No, I'm just saying it's a good movie.
Thank you for the correction. Ordinary People and the Cars video, and then we never heard from him again.
Right.
Pretty much. He's been in some goofy series maybe in the last few years.
Youngest? Best supporting
actor
ever?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Mm-hmm. I think that is right. Tony and Roselle, you're in Chicago's Morning Answer.
The one car song that's emblazoned in my mind is the one they played when Phoebe Cates got out of the pool in Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
When Phoebe Cates got out of the pool in Fast Times, yes.
I was about 13 at the time, and every time that song comes out, I get a flashback.
Yeah. And I hope you didn't do your impersonation of Judge Reinhold in the bathroom, Tony. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. Greg in Jefferson Park.
Hey, good morning, guys. Best car song is Since You're Gone.
Since You've Been Gone.
It was never a real big hit, but it's a fantastic tune, man.
That is good. Do we have
Since You've Been Gone? By the
I don't know if I pulled that one. I got, you know, wait. Thanks for the call.
What is Since You've Been Gone? Now I want to hear it. All right.
Since You've Been Gone, out of my mind, can't take it. That, right? Yeah.
Since You've Been Gone.
Right?
No, that's not it.
Isn't it? No.
Hold on.
There's another one I really like, but this is Benjamin Orr again, Moving in Stereo.
Oh.
That's a great song. All right, switching gears, we'll get back to spinning records a little bit later. Felicity Huffman, she's going to the joint, 14 days in prison, $30,000 fine, 1 year of supervised release, 250 hours of community service. Too stiff, too light, just too bad, this whole saga. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. What do you think of Felicity Huffman? Mrs. William H. Macy being sentenced to prison time for her shameless conduct.
I heard that headline all weekend long.
Thank you.
14 days, that's ridiculous. Her sentence was her waiting for her sentencing, because that's the worst time. You know, all the people that I know that are in prison say waiting for you to get the decision from a judge is worse than anything that you go through.
Sure.
It's a waste of time. This is a photo
for the
op.
Sentence.
This is going to bolster her career. Oh, now she's done hard times. She went to prison. Just give her the fine, the $30,000 fine, which she did, and 250 hours, which, by the way, she has to spend time with less fortunate families than hers, so she can know what they really go through, which I want to know what the heck that means. That's what the judge sentenced her to. She's not cleaning up garbage on the side of a highway, which I thought would be a nice visual. She's working with less fortunate families.
I'm still trying to get over this idea. Waiting for the sentence is the worst part.
Yeah, when you're sitting there for 6 months waiting, oh, my God, am I going to go to jail for 30 years? Am I going to go to jail for a month? Am I going to be on probation, which that's what they were fighting for? It's not. It's
sure.
A horrible time.
Sure. Now, the 30 years I spent in prison, That wasn't great either. But the 6 months waiting for my 30-year sentence, that was what really got it.
Well, I'm just saying the sentencing begins the day that you're convicted, and then you have to wait until you find out if you have jail time or not. But 14 days, stupid, a colossal waste of tax dollars, money. It's just dumb. And what are they going to do? She'll be in there for 7 days, maybe take an alcohol treatment class and be out in three. You know, I mean, the whole thing is just ridiculous. They're just doing this. Now, what's the other actress's name? Lori Loughlin?
Yeah.
Yeah. She's going to do some hard, hard time. Like, if I were her, I'd be shaking in my boots.
I don't understand the philosophy. Wait, what's your point is that this is a waste of taxpayer dollars? Well, I mean, you say that about every prison term. You say that about adjudicating the case altogether.
The message was sent to scare her to think that she was going to be going to prison for a long time, and said time is 14 days. And no. I just think
she never thought she was going to prison for a long time.
Well, there is a possibility she'd go to prison for a long time. Do you think the sentence is just 14 days?
Prosecutors recommended a month, so she knew what the prosecutor's recommendation was, which is basically your top, you know, the most draconian, the most severe sentence you could have gotten.
Okay.
It was 1 month.
All right.
So she knew she wasn't facing hard time. So let's just, you know, bring this in here. So the question is, why not sentence her to prison for committing this sort of fraud, for undermining the integrity of the collegiate admissions process, along with, you know, co-conspirators like the guy she paid $15,000 to. To manipulate her SAT, her daughter's SAT score.
Do you know how many people I know who just write $15,000 checks to selective enrollment schools to get their kids in? I know so many people.
So
what? To get them into Jones, to get $15,000 is nothing. That's nothing.
So what? I don't understand your point. It's nothing, and so what? What do you mean? It's nothing to her. Okay, and.
I don't think she should go to jail for 14 days for writing a $15,000 check.
What if it would have been $150,000? What's the difference?
The more you write, the more fraudulent your behavior is. She just wanted to change.
No.
Lori Loughlin spent $500,000. She put her kids into USC.
The bigger the check, the bigger the fraud? Not really.
The longer the sentence. I'd feel differently about this if she spent $150,000. She just spent $15,000.
It only cost her $15,000 to get the SAT test manipulated, so that was the market clearing price for Rick Singer. That's her fault?
She got a good deal compared to Lori Loughlin, who paid him $500,000.
So what is your point? Fraud is fraud as it pertains to the moral turpitude of the crime, which is driving the sentence. 15, 25, 50, 150, 500. I mean, this is the old Winston Churchill. We've established what you are. Now we're just arguing about price. I don't understand the argument against her spending a couple weeks in prison. Not to scare her. To punish her, right? There's two aspects of justice, retributive and restorative. This is not restorative. This is retributive for perpetrating a fraud in the college admissions process and along with other people. And so you're going to serve real time and also to send the message. And this is often done with celebrities. Sometimes celebrities have the ability to buy their way out of justice. And sometimes they get more justice than the every man would, because you have courts that want to send a message to the larger public that just because you're a celebrity doesn't mean you're above the law. So it cuts both ways. And this way it cut against Felicity Huffman. So what?
Do you think she should have spent the month in jail? Or 14 days is appropriate?
The jail sentence is fine, is my point. And prosecutors recommend a month. She gets 2 weeks. A $30,000 fine. I mean, you talk about the fine. Talk about money, a certain level of money being nothing to her. $30,000 for the fine. The fine should have been more. In addition, also, I want to know how William H. Macy skated on all this. Well done, Jim in Tampa. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, guys. After getting past the being upset with the celebrities for getting favorable treatment, you really kind of think the idea of protecting the purity of the college admissions process is a joke. Where are all the college football and basketball recruiters that should be right there next to her for at least 14 days? I just can't get worked up over it.
Well, thanks for the call, Jim. I mean, the college, you're right. I mean, the real opportunity here is to have a conversation about college admissions generally, how that process. I mean, the exceptions or lowered standards that are provided scholarship athletes and so forth. Well, that's not committing a fraud. Those are the rules. Now, you may think the rules should be changed, but those individuals that are admitting whatever, the star linebacker with lower test scores, lower GPA and so forth, than his peers in the student body, that's sort of a different conversation. But the larger conversation about admissions, yeah, I agree. Legacy admissions, gone. What do you think about that? Getting rid of legacy admissions. What do you think about doing what I've always suggested, what I suggested back when I ran for governor, and this was in the height of the U of I admission scandal with the legislative scholarships that state legislators used to be able to hand out here to put, you know, the favored sons and daughters of their political donors and political friends ahead of the line. It's so easy to do the college admissions process. You do it the same way the CSO interviews prospective musicians. Yeah, CSO puts them behind a screen. All you can hear is the music. Doesn't matter.
It's so awesome.
Gender, race, religion. Doesn't matter. Why couldn't you do college admissions in a similarly blind way? You get an application. It's automatically assigned a random number. Names and everything, name is removed. And so the admissions committee just gets a file with a number, and you make your judgment based on the quality of that person's academic and extracurricular record. Why not do it that way? What do you think about that? And here's the other thing that could be done.
There might be a whole gaggle of ladies.
I don't care if the class is 100% women. I don't 100% Asian women.
100% white.
100% black women, black men. I don't care. Doesn't matter to me. Matters to me is rewarding people that put together the best record, particularly at taxpayer-funded schools, land-grant universities like U of I. But how about generally, since the federal government has insinuated itself, and not without support, into higher education by subsidizing it? You know, everybody who plays ball with the government, that comes with strings, or could. Here's how you could potentially pass a federal law that stipulates that colleges shall not receive research grant money, shall not be subsidized by Sallie Mae, unless they have an admissions process like the one I described. I mean, we're all in the era of non-discrimination. Okay, well, let's do it across the board comprehensively. And I'm loath to have federal get into this business, but I just think we're so addled on all this non-discrimination talk. Except for protected classes, and those that the number of those in the protected class continues to grow as people reinvent themselves, re-identify. What about that? What about tying federal dollars to a blind admissions process? That gets rid of, I mean, it doesn't necessarily get rid of this fraud, because remember, they were manipulating SAT scores and they were lying about extracurricular activities. But it would certainly make the admissions process more transparent and more meritocratic. 312-642-5600, Turnkey DepPro answer line. 646-36-DA, Turnkey DepPro text line. Ed in Oak Brook.
Yeah, you know what? I really don't care what happens to this particular lady. I don't even know who she is. But what bothers me the most is that the people at these schools, and because I've actually met them when my kids were applying and so forth, you know what? I'd rather deal with drug dealers than these people, because you can tell that they're fake as can be. What has happened to them? Are they losing their jobs? Are they losing their pensions? They come across so high and mighty and ethical and everything like that. They're the biggest scumbags in the world, especially Illinois State or whatever they call it, and UIC. DePaul is even the worst, but anyone can get into DePaul. But these people come across so mighty, so intellectual. They're nothing but scum. And I wish that they would investigate them. And I want to hear jobs being chopped or heads being chopped at these places. I don't care what happens to Phillip City. I don't even know what her name, Hoffman.
Yeah, but, Ed, stop pretending like you didn't watch Desperate Housewives. You know exactly
every
who
Sunday night, you know what you did.
I don't even know what was it about.
Thanks
Wisteria
for the call,
Lane,
Ed.
Come on.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Please, Ed.
I think he's a big Eva Longoria fan.
You're not fooling anybody. Phillip in Blue Island.
This is a story, I think 2011. This black woman, homeless at that point, but she put up an address for her five-year-old son. I think it's Bridgeport, Connecticut, but the school was in another city or whatever. And she was sentenced to 5 years. Actually serving this 5 years. She'd probably be getting out shortly. But my question is, hopefully she's out by now. Shoot, this is 2011. But my point to Amy, should she have been charged? She's sentenced to 5 years for just putting in a fraudulent address?
This is in Chicago?
Bridgeport, Connecticut.
Oh, Connecticut. And this was
her name was Tanya McDowell.
I don't know that. I don't remember that story. But I mean, yeah, that's a fair question. I mean, yeah. I mean, you're right. So you're manipulating the system. So you committed a fraud on the admissions process and whatever statute she violated in Connecticut. But yeah, 5 year sentence. I mean, she didn't have Felicity Huffman's lawyers. That's for sure.
No, she didn't.
No, I mean, but that's a fair point, Philip. Thanks for the call. The uneven sentences in these cases. I don't know. I think, as I said before, I have no problem with a jail sentence for Felicity Huffman, for Lori Loughlin. Fraud should come with serious consequences, number one. Number two, I go back to say it's about the admissions process and having a conversation. Frankly, at that level, as well as at the K-12 level, think about big cities and the other discussion we've had at the K-12 level about, you know, principals lists. And the principal is empowered at these selective enrollment schools.
Principal discretion.
Yeah, to say, okay, we'll waive this person in.
All you have to do is write a check, Dan. And the bigger the check, the better your chances are. And I do know somebody else, too, who did write a $15,000 check to a selective enrollment school. And his daughter still didn't get in. And then he tried to get the money back, and they said, sorry, a donation's a donation.
Well, right, yeah. If they gave the money back, that would sort of implicate everybody, wouldn't it?
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. There are two things the left believes should be left unregulated to the point of lawlessness: America's borders and abortionists. So on the latter count, should we be surprised that we may have our very own Kermit Gosnell here in Illinois, the abortion dumping ground of the Midwest, even though he performed at clinics, and I use that term very loosely, in Indiana.
Slaughterhouse is what they looked like.
Dr. Ulrich Klopfer died on September 3rd and found at his property in Will County 2,246 medically preserved infant remains. Will County Coroner's Office releasing a statement that... Will County government across the board. Will County Sheriff's detectives, crime scene investigators, representatives from the coroner's office arrived at an address in unincorporated Will County. Personnel were directed to an area of the property where 2,246 medically preserved fetal remains were located. The Will County Coroner's Office took possession of the remains. The family, Klopfer's family, cooperating with the investigation, report.
Yeah, they're the ones who found, the father died. They went to the home, and right now they're not saying exactly where these fetal remains were found, but they were well-preserved, which is very strange, in jars. And they're the ones who called police at 3:30 on Friday and said, "We need you need to come over here." Now, subsequently, this doctor had a female friend in Creed. This is what I'm learning. And he rented out her, it's either a storage locket or a garage, and they found an additional 120 fetuses there. So he was an abortion doctor in South Bend, Indiana. Until his license was taken in
2016.
And partially because he gave an abortion to a 13-year-old girl and didn't have the proper documentation, basically didn't have the parents' approval to do this abortion.
The licensing board in Indiana disturbed that Klopfer didn't give pain medication to all women, only automatically to those under the age of 16 and then to adults who could pay him extra money. When he did give the medication to women, his staff weren't qualified to follow best practices for the drugs. Oh, not trained, were they? No oversight. This is eerily reminiscent of Kermit Gosnell, the abortionist in Philadelphia who is now serving a life sentence for murder. If you haven't seen the Gosnell movie, you should see it. He kept fetal remains in jars in his office.
In plastic bags in his refrigerator.
His staff was unqualified to be involved in performing medical procedures on women. Frankly, so was he, obviously. You know, women dying on his operating table. And so 2,246 on his property. By the way,
Was it trophies? Like, look at what I did. I mean, this is a sick, twisted individual.
Klopfer, I know, safe, legal, and rare, once performed abortion on 10-year-old girl, 13-year-old girl. He did face misdemeanor charges in 2014 for failing to report an abortion performed on a 13-year-old girl who was raped. That Indiana law requires such an abortion in those circumstances to be reported within 3 days. He was, pled out on paying fines and court costs.
And the charge was later dropped after Klopfer completed a pretrial diversion program, whatever that means. And even though his clinic closed down in 2016, Dan, maybe he was still performing abortions. We don't know. I mean, he said that after 43 years of performing abortions, he told a panel during one of these hearings that he had never lost a patient. But if he's been performing abortions for 43 years and keeping the dead fetuses, that's worse than a horror film.
312-642-5600 Turnkey and DePro answer line 646-36DA Turnkey DePro text line. Are you surprised that there's more potential Gosnells out there? Are you surprised by what was found in Dr. Klopfer's residence? If you just think about the culture of death that surrounds the abortion industry, Planned Parenthood. Yeah, ladies, don your pee hats, you champagne socialist ladies running around. Abortion is a sacrament. Does it feel like a sacrament when you hear this story? David Dalyden and the undercover videos exposing Planned Parenthood for trafficking in baby body parts. I know there was a DC press corps blackout on the story, but it still got out. Videos are available. The work. We play the audio of every video that was released.
What TV station is going to actually send a reporter out to the scene? Because all I saw was a VO. From Capture News, that's the stringer that goes and they shoot the video. Who's going to dig a little deeper?
Do we have comment from a noted biblical scholar and presidential candidate, the good Christian? You know, he's a Episcopal. Mayor Pete. Where's Mannequin Pete? This is South Bend.
That's right.
Any comment? Do you have a biblical verse for us, Mannequin Pete? That would put this into proper context for us. You know, breath of life type stuff. Yeah, are you still kicking it with Charlemagne talking about, those who don't support abortion just haven't gotten the wrong woman pregnant? Guffawing along to statements like that, Mannequin Pete. while moralizing to people about the abortion on demand culture that you otherwise support, as does the entire Democrat Socialist Party, with a few exceptions.
Yeah, he ran clinics in Fort Wayne, Gary, and the longest time he ran a clinic was in South Bend. So Mayor Pete should be something.
What do you think? Notre Dame University? Great Catholic institution that is. Any comment on what was happening in your backyard? Who was operating in your backyard? Are you surprised by this? Or do you understand that when you legitimize and, frankly, underwrite a ghoulish business, you get ghouls?
Well, he didn't take care of the remains as medically mandated, and why he chose to store them at home are questions I don't know if will ever be unanswered. I mean, neighbors say that the family, his kids, hired someone to bring in one of those huge dumpsters to clean out the garage, and they were there for 2 days cleaning it out, and on the third day, police were called. And neighbors were trying to figure out what was going on. We didn't think it was nothing like this, where he spent time to store 2,246 fetuses. So disgusting.
Did you hear the abortion mills? Did you hear the locations of the abortion mills? South Bend, Fort Wayne, and Gary. Anything strike you as noteworthy about that? Anybody? Do you know anything about the region? Gary, Fort Wayne, and South Bend. Anything particular about those communities that's noteworthy with respect to this issue?
How did his wife too not know what was going on? She and the family, they said, are shocked, and they want to get this resolved as soon as possible.
Resolved how? Get back to my question?
Yeah, let's get back to your question.
Substantial black populations.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Right. These abortion mills locate in poor minority neighborhoods and communities. You think they're doing that out of love for those minority families, black families and Gary? You think the abortion mill that Dr. Klupfer ran in Gary was just about making sure that poor black women had equal access to quality women's health care services? Is that what you believe? Or do you believe it's predatory and racist? And you believe, or don't you, that the underwriters of this ghoulish business that propagates these ghouls like Dr. Klupfer, and I'm talking about the North Shore types who are on the board of Personal PAC here in Illinois, including the former Republican governor and his wife, and I'm talking about, of course, Planned Parenthood. Those people don't need to be having any more children. Isn't that a phrase that you're familiar with, coming from that quarter, the Champagne Socialists? How about now? Are you going to avert your eyes to what was found at Klopfer's house? We like to think, you know, we just, safe, legal, rare, women's choice, women's body, so on and so forth. And so we treat it as an abstraction. How about confronting the results? You want to look at those jars? Why not? Why wouldn't you?
I don't even know if they'll shoot. I mean, why wouldn't you? Somebody gets killed, you normally stand out there and get video of them taking the body away.
Why wouldn't you?
I don't know if they'll do this.
Why wouldn't you want to look at whether they do it or not? That's not the question. Wouldn't you want to look at it? Wouldn't you want to see it? Because it's no big deal. It's not a big deal, right? That's what we're told. What's the problem with showing the images? You know, some
number of late-term abortions.
Some human tissue was found in place. You know, I mean, it's just like, what, like a gallbladder?
No, these are substantial, is what I was told.
Chip in St. Charles, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan, they busted this guy for performing an illegal abortion on a 13-year-old, mm-hmm. and they never got a search warrant for his home and went and searched his home.
No,
they should have found this years ago.
I think he's been piling these bodies up for decades.
Thanks for the call, Chip.
Or maybe just keeping certain ones. But in the state of Indiana, you're supposed to cremate or bury the fetus after an abortion. It's state law.
Mike in Crown Point.
Hi, guys. 2 points. First of all, if they ever just showed a videotape on television, no commentary of an actual abortion, the opinion would change overnight to 98% opposed. I guarantee you. If you ever actually watched one happen, you'd be aghast. Second thing is, you know, we've got a cowardly Republican Congress. We had all three branches a couple of years ago, and they still give these guys $500 million a year. What if we gave $500 million to the NRA for gun safety? The left would go nuts. So, anyway, that's all I had to say.
Thanks for the call, Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
It turns out a month ago, Mannequin Pete renewed his support for that South Bend abortion mill.
Oh, really?
With the history of health and safety violations. Dr. Klupfer's mill.
What was it called again, then?
Whole Women's Health.
Right, thank you.
Dozens of health and safety violations in three Texas facilities between 2011 and 2017. And in Indiana State Department of Health denied Whole Women's Health of South Bend's license application due to lack of reputable and responsible character and failure to disclose information related to additional clinics, including the Texas clinics. Spokesman for Mannequin Pete. Mm-hmm. The South Bend clinic would be the only one for radius of several counties. It's a restriction on a woman's right if she is low income and doesn't have a vehicle and she has to visit multiple times, but the clinic is dozens of miles away. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I basically did predict what he would say and what the spokesman would say, because they all say the same thing. How does that statement square with what we know to be true now? Feel right? Feel on the mark to you? Matt and Alsup, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Hard to follow the conversation because it's pretty hard to listen to, but I think I just want to say one thing. There's a reason there's that proverbial comment, everybody's got their skeletons in their closets, and I think shame is a word that needs to be discussed a little bit about this whole thing. Everybody knows there's an underlying shame, a great moral reversion to this abortion agenda in the United States and in the world, but definitely in the United States. And that's why bodies pile up and blood climbs out from the ground of these places, because it's an atrocity and everybody knows it. That's all I need to say.
Everybody knows it. Thanks for the call, Matt. Right. And then when you're confronted with it in these cases, or with David DeLayden's undercover work on Planned Parenthood, who averts their eyes and who's willing to stand and see what they support, reconcile their position with what they see, what they know to be true, that they can no longer avoid, can no longer treat as an abstraction because it's right there in jars.
And in bags.
And in bags. Tony and Roselle.
Yeah, I don't know. This conversation is just aimed at the choir. People on the left don't see anything to be outraged about. These aren't people or babies. They're just masses of tissue. They're just tumors. So you're never going to convince people who support abortion. They just don't care.
Maybe. Thanks for the call, Tony. Maybe, but you've had
some people change their... A lot of women have changed their minds, and men.
And abortionists.
And abortionists, right.
We had Dr. Tony Levitino on the show. We've had others on the show that had conversions. So, yeah, I mean, it's not everybody. There's some rabid people that will never change. I agree with that. But it's not everybody. People change their minds all the time. Reasonable people change their minds all the time. It's okay. But I just want, even the most rabid, to confront what they support. I want them to stand next to those jars and explain to us their position and how they would characterize what's happened here. I'm sure it'll be the way they try to distance themselves from Gosnell, which is, that what happened at Gosnell's mill was terrible. Planned Parenthood doesn't support that. He's an exception. Kermit Gosnell's an exception. There's always bad apples and then the industry and so on and so forth. We certainly don't support that. And this, you know, just redoubles our commitment to make sure that these mills are clean and safe and protecting women's and their reproductive choices and so on and so forth. That's what you'll get. That's what you get in this case, too. Everything's a one-off.
And from these fetuses that they found, well, from these fetuses, I've been told that they're going to decide if any of them were born alive and then murdered by this man. And then he's decided to store them, like, wait, trophies? I don't understand why. It's so disgusting.
There's only one radio show in Chicago talking about today's biggest stories and telling you what they really mean. That show is this one. Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Back in the early 60s, Creepshow Joe Biden was a member of the Jets, and he was also a pool guard.
Yeah, he was a lifeguard, and he was watching out over the deep end.
And one of the sharks showed up, one of the sharks named Corn Pop in this adaptation of the William Lawrence classic.
Yeah, over the weekend he returned to the pool where it all started and showed some street cred, Dan, by taking on Corn Pop, Top Sugar Pop.
If you never got around to seeing the prequel, you're just familiar with Cory Booker and T-Bone. Uh-huh. You really want to hear the prequel as recounted by Joe Biden at the dedication of the pool at which he was a lifeguard in his honor just 2 years ago. He tells the whole story about Joe and Corn Pop.
This was the diving board area, and I was one of the guards, and there weren't allowed to. It was a 3-meter board, and you fell off sideways, you landed on the damn, the darn cement over there. And Corn Pop was a bad dude, and he ran a bunch of bad boys. And I did. Oh, and back in those days, to show how things have changed, one of the things you had to use, if you used pomade in your hair, you had to wear a bathing cap. And so he was up on the board, wouldn't listen to me. I said, hey, Esther, you, off the board, or I'll come up and drag you off. Well, he came off, and he said, I'll meet you outside. My car, this was mostly, these were all public housing behind it. My car, there was a gate out here. I parked my car outside the gate. And he said, I'll be waiting for you. He was waiting for three guys in straight razors. Not a joke. There was a guy named Bill Wright, Mouse, the only white guy, and he did all the pools. He was the mechanic. And I said, what am I going to do? He said, come down here in the basement where mechanics, where all the pool filter is. You know, the chain, there used to be a chain that went across the deep end. And he cut off a 6-foot length of chain. He folded up. He said, you walk out with that chain. And you walk to the car and say, you may cut me, man, but I'm going to wrap this chain around your head. I said, you kidding me?
Do you want to hear how it ends?
This is be much better. I like the version better with the Leonard Bernstein music, but this isn't bad. I'll tell you what. How old is this guy? An Esther Williams reference? Okay.
This. You want to hear how it ends? This is how it ends, guys. It's really exciting.
So I walked out with the chain.
Yeah.
And I walked up to my car. And they had, in those days, used to remember the straight razor. You'd bang them on the curb, get them rusty, put them in a rain barrel, get them rusty. And I looked at him, but I was smart then. I said, first of all, I said, when I tell you get off the board, you get off the board, and I'll kick you out again. But I shouldn't have called you, Esther Williams. I apologize for that. I apologize, but I didn't know that apology was going to work. He said, you apologize to me? I said, I apologize for that. Not for throwing you out, but I apologize for what I said. He said, okay, close the straight razor, and my heart began to beat again.
Oh. And the little kids behind them are wondering, who is Esther Williams?
And then they did a dance number, and it was great.
But he has been roasted on Twitter. I mean, with the Corn Pops and people, everyone holding up the Corn Pops. And what's your street name, Dan? Do you have one?
I just love this story, and he provides a name to corroborate the story.
Yeah. What's his name? Fruit Loops.
For more on this and the presidential race, it's remarkable that there is one. We're pleased to be joined by Diamond and Silk, host of The Viewer's View, contributors to Fox Nation, stars of the documentary Dummycrats. Diamond Silk, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
So does Joe Biden's courage in the face of straight blade wielding ruffians like Corn Pop change your opinion of his worthiness to be president?
He ain't gonna never be president. I'm surprised he didn't talk about Sugar Smack or Rice Krispie was they there.
I mean, I
don't know about Joe Biden. I don't believe that he's playing with the full deck.
No.
And my personal opinion, people have given him, given him a pass.
Mm-hmm.
As if he can do or say anything he wants and everybody look the other way. And you know who I question? I question Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Why in the heck did he pick this guy to be his vice president?
Mm.
I think he was, but
Joe ain't home. That's
yeah,
right.
I think he was persuaded by the story of how he handled Snap, Crackle, and Pop earlier.
I like Sugar Smacks. That's a good one. So, ladies, I'm sure you watched Thursday night's debate. Did that change the state of the race at all? Besides Julian Castro not going to be invited back?
It ain't changed no state of anything because they all look like they in a state of shock because they trying to figure out how they going to beat Trump.
That's right.
And when you have them all sitting up there trying to figure out how they going to beat Trump, how they going to advocate and work for illegal aliens and leave Americans
mm-hmm.
behind, this is nothing but a clown show is what it is.
That's right.
You know, all of those people on that stage collectively together have about 390 years worth of government experience. And now they want to change something. So now you got this one man, President Donald J. Trump, only been in office almost 3 years and has managed to do more in 3 years than they've done collectively in 390-some years.
That's right.
What, Biden's been in office 50 years, and now he want to do something? All of them can go somewhere and sit down.
I wanted to get your take on the New York Times story, in quotation marks, that unleashed all of the Democrat socialist presidential candidates, those clowns you were talking about, to renew their call for Brett Kavanaugh's impeachment. This story about another alleged incident in college recounted in this book by a couple of New York Times reporters that's coming out tomorrow, that even they had to make an editor's note correction to the story. Even the alleged victim doesn't recall it happening, but this is nonetheless the basis to impeach Kavanaugh.
Oh, you know what? Accusations, allegations without accurate information is what we see going on here.
Fake news.
And I see all of these people calling for the impeachment because of something that somebody is alleging that happened when he was, what, in high school or college?
Mm.
Well, I tell you what, let's go back in their past.
Mm-hmm.
We can start with who was calling for it? Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Kamala, let's go back in your past. Didn't you admit that you was getting high while you were locking men up for getting high?
Mm-hmm.
Wasn't you a young girl preying on an old married man because
mm-hmm.
you was dating him, was you not?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you impeach her?
Oh, boy.
Somebody, who else calling for impeachment?
Mm-hmm.
Biden, let's take a look at this here. Now, there is no evidence on what they're accusing Kavanaugh of, but we have evidence on Biden touching and feeling on women and
mm-hmm.
children.
Mm-hmm.
But they got him running for president of the United States. I mean, people need to look at that.
Right.
I think that Kavanaugh should sue the heck out of the New York Times. Shame on them for slandering.
That's
right. That is slander.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they're doing.
That's right.
And they don't want the president to be able to pick another judge. Is what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why they're so antsy calling for impeachment. Where everybody that's calling for impeachment, all of them got a pass. They need to be impeached.
That's right.
Now, what are you two ladies doing to help President Trump in the 2020 election?
I'm speaking out. I'm being very vocal about what I see. When I look at them trying to push Biden up to be the president of the United States, you know, when he says certain things, to me it echoes the sentiments of bigotry and racism. When I look at Elizabeth Warren, how she's running around here as if she have a moral compass,
mm-hmm.
She even calling for the impeachment, I believe, of Kavanaugh. But didn't she lie?
about her being a Native American. Didn't she go to school based on that lie?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And she had a free ride.
And she got a free ride, mm-hmm. talking about she was a minority and she's lily white.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe we need to go back and look at that.
Mm-hmm.
When I look at these people just being straight liars, pandering for black people, calling for reparations, let me tell you something. Black people don't need reparations. They need liberation from the Democrat Party and their ideology.
That's right.
Okay. When I see that, silly. So what we're going to do, we're going to continue to speak out and let people know not to be bamboozled or hoodwinked by these nasty, low-down Democrats.
That's right.
Well, speaking of that and the black voter and, you know, Trump's somewhat interesting numbers among black voters, higher than perhaps previous Republican presidents. I don't know if that's going to translate into a higher percentage of the vote in 2020, but we'll get your take on that. But I also wanted your take on this, the 1619 project that's launched by the New York Times. They are getting that practicum into classrooms to recast American history as starting in 1619 when the first African slaves were brought to this continent, sold in Virginia. And you know, to make America's history almost singularly about slavery and the victimization blacks have suffered, apparently to them, over the last 400 years.
Well, first of all, what they want to do is start a race war, is what they want to do, and which is so sad. But to go back into history and to try to make black people feel as if we are victims.
Mm-hmm.
I ain't never been no slave. I ain't never picked cotton. Now, my mother picked cotton, and her mama picked cotton, but I ain't never been no slave.
Mm-hmm.
Now, our ancestors were slaves. Now, guess who sold the first slave into slavery?
Mm-hmm.
It was the black man that
right.
did that over in Africa.
Right.
And when I see that they're trying to make people live in the pain of their ancestors,
that's right.
they would do anything they can to get somebody to vote for them.
Mm-hmm.
They know how to play on the intelligence of some black people, not all, because black people are waking up to this foolishness.
That's right. It's what it is. It's a form of indoctrination. If they can indoctrinate our young kids, the young, fragile mind, to make it appear like they are the slaves that they speak of. But here's the deal. Why won't the New York Times talk about that it was the Democrat Party that enslaves the slaves?
That's right.
Why won't they talk about it was the Democrat Party? That's the one bit of information, important piece of information that's missing from this whole ordeal. We could talk about history. We could talk about the statues. We could talk about the wars. But why won't they name the Democrat as the party of enslaving the slaves,
mm-hmm.
the black people? Why won't they talk about that?
But the party of Jim Crow, the party of KKK.
Uh-huh. The party of white supremacists. White supremacists was the party of the Democrats.
That's right. And please don't tell me that the party switched. No, Republicans did not leave the Democrat Party and switch to Republicans. That's a lie. Who switched was black people.
Yes.
When Democrats started giving everything away for free, that's when black people switched and started voting for Democrats.
But right now, it looks like black people are switching back because they realize that the Democrat Party means them no good. And I am ready to see the Democrat Party destroyed just like they destroyed the black family.
That's right.
All right. Diamond and Silk, Trump supporters, host of The Viewer's View, contributors to Fox Nation, stars of the documentary Dummycrats. Ladies, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, and they joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook. Or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, locked and loaded. That's what President Trump said the United States is per the Iranian attack on Saudi Arabia's oil fields. Saudi Arabia oil supply was attacked. There's reason to believe that we know the culprit and are locked and loaded depending on verification. But we are waiting to hear from the kingdom as to who they believe was the cause of this attack and under what terms we would proceed, Trump tweeted. His Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was clear that it was the Iranians and not the Houthi rebels, or it was the Houthi rebels carrying out the Iranians' orders to attack these the oil production capacity of Saudi Arabia.
But this is a huge deal. I mean, 5% of the global oil production was affected by this.
Yeah, and the Saudis say they're going to be back up and running at full speed in 2 weeks.
Well, I hope so, because it's 5.7 million barrels of crude oil per day that came out of the refinery in that other oil field.
Yeah, and makes it all the more pressing for us to be energy independent, which we basically are. Kellyanne Conway was on Fox News Sunday yesterday to talk about this. Here's what she had to say in terms of translating the president's position on Iran.
The Iranian regime is responsible for this attack on civilian areas and infrastructure vital to our global energy supply, and we're not going to stand for that. In fact, our Department of Energy stands ready to tap into this strategic reserve, petroleum reserve, if we must, to stabilize the global energy supply. But more importantly, Secretary Pompeo and Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin just this last week stood in the White House press briefing room and announced additional sanctions. And that is because we will continue to call out malign behavior, continue with the maximum pressure campaign in Iran. And this is a president who withdrew us from a very bad nuclear deal with a ne'er-do-well regime. So this president also, through his energy policy bill, has made us less dependent on these foreign dictators and bad regimes for our energy supply. We now in the U.S. are net exporters of natural gas and oil at the highest levels this country has ever seen, and that will continue.
What about striking Iranian oil fields, as Lindsey Graham floated?
Secretary Pompeo, our nation's chief diplomat, keep many options on the table, particularly when it comes to retaliating against malign behavior and protecting American interests and Americans and our American economy. So I won't get ahead of Secretary Pompeo and the president in saying that.
What about Trump's interest in meeting with the top mullah, Rouhani?
Well, the president will always consider his options. And we've never committed to that meeting at the United Nations General Assembly. The president has just said he's looking at it. And so I'll allow the president to announce a meeting or a non-meeting.
For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of books including Wiki at War and Private Sector Public Wars. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good to be with you. Ben, it's like a kind of an exciting time here.
Yeah, I'd say. It's gotten more exciting over the weekend. The question I'd like to start with, Wall Street Journal, in their op-ed on the topic, essentially suggests that Trump owes John Bolton an apology. Bolton repeatedly warning Iran would take advantage of any perceived weakness, and Trump's lack of response to the drone strike, the shooting down of an American drone over the summer, and his interest in meeting with Rouhani is provocative to the Iranians.
I read that Wall Street. I'm not sure where they're getting this from. I mean, it was Trump's foreign policy. It is Trump's foreign policy. It will be Trump's foreign policy. The administration was tough on Iran before John showed up. I thought John actually did a great job. I thought there was a lot of continuity in that. And the Wall Street Journal piece just struck me as odd. I mean, it reads a lot of things into there, most of which we have no evidence for. It just reads like somebody connecting dots they want to connect to make an opinion they want to have.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think what happened, though, is going to lead to military conflict?
I don't know. We should start with the basics. You guys talked about the oil supply. That's a good point. And oil prices, spot crude always jumps when, something happens in the Middle East. But the reality is right now the world is flush with oil. Even the Saudis said they're not going to slow deliveries, and China's sitting on millions of barrels of oil. I mean, so the global market is not starving for oil, so it is not creating an energy crisis. That we got to start with that. The next thing is it's an attack on Saudi Arabia. It's not an attack on the United States or American forces. We don't have a defense treaty with Saudi Arabia. We don't have an obligation to defend Saudi Arabia from its enemies. Maybe they should assign the Middle East security architecture, which would have been a mutual defense treaty, and then maybe we'd have a different situation here. And I think facts matter. I do think you know, before the United States uses coercive force, it needs to make sure it has all the facts, and it makes that case in the international community, and makes the case why the use of force is appropriate.
Is the suggestion by Graham, Senator Graham, that we should consider striking Iranian oil fields, is that something you believe should be kept on the table pending the complete assemblage of the facts?
Well, I thought Kellyanne's comments were exactly spot on and professional. I think in situations like this, that's the appropriate thing to say. You say all options are on the table. The Iranians have to, I mean, whether they actually physically did this or not, we all know that they're behind it, and they should have to pay a steep price for this. And let's not forget, people ignore that they are paying a steep price. 90% of the Iranian oil is off the market. That country is in dire straits because of the U.S. pressure campaign. Iran's not in the driver's seat here.
Right. And so to that point, is there any judiciousness in even considering relaxing sanctions, to have a sit down with Rouhani, to talk about some sort of, détente in the region?
Well, right now, I think that would actually be a big mistake. If the Iranians did something this provocative, and your next step was to say, okay, let's just talk, pretend like it never happened, that would look incredibly weak. I'm not saying take diplomacy off the table, and the U.S. is unlikely to do that, but the timing for that isn't right now. What's appropriate is the U.S. should make the Iranians pay a price for the activity they did, and then in the future, if they want to, be open to negotiating, I think it's true, but just like when, the Taliban did a terrorist attack in downtown Kabul, administration realized that's not the right time to sign a peace deal with the Taliban. Mm. I think so, too, when the Iranians just attack another country, probably not the right time to say that, and then just ignore that and say, okay, let's talk.
So the Houthi rebels came out, the Houthi rebels from Yemen came out claiming responsibility for the attack, but do you think that it was orchestrated, though, by Iran? Or do you think
Yeah, I only have publicly available information to go on, and right now the publicly information available is both sketchy, contradictory, and incomplete. I mean, first of all, we all know that the Houthi rebels are backed by the Iranians, that they would not have the capacity or capability to do anything unless the Iranians gave that to them. So automatically there's some degree of culpability on the part of the Iranians, particularly since before the Iranians have encouraged the Houthis to attack Saudi Arabia. Having said that, I don't know what the rest of the story is. It could well be a situation where strikes came from the Houthis and they potentially came from Iranian elements that were positioned in Iraq, or maybe they came from Iran, or a combination of them. I just don't see the evidence. We don't really have a conclusive chronology and accounting of events yet. I think it's the first thing the United States would want to put on the table before it conducted, if it was going to take further retaliatory action. It was coercive. So I think that's the first thing they'd put on the table.
How does this impact the Israeli election, and how does the outcome of that election impact the region and our relationship?
Well, I mean, I think the one we can be most confident in is the relationship between the United States and Israel. That is a key bilateral relationship with the United States. Israel's our anchor into the region. It's our really only truly dependable ally. The administration's made a complete commitment to that. That's unlikely to change regardless of the outcome of the election.
And what's your handle on what that outcome's going to be? Is will Bibi survive?
I don't know. I mean, these... This
how important?
Kind of,
how important? You know, how important is
for
it
for us? No, yeah. I'm just saying. For us, this is an existential crisis. In Israel, stuff like this is, hey, it's Monday.
Yeah.
Well, okay, but how important is it that Bibi survives for stability in the region? I understand our relationship with Israel won't change in terms of being allies, but it could change the approach in the region, which then necessarily brings us in.
It's always very difficult to tell. I mean, first of all, Israeli politicians are like anybody else. They say all kinds of things on the campaign trail. It doesn't really tell you how they're going to govern. The other thing is again, in Israel, what we've consistently seen is governments by coalition, right? And then the policy tends to reflect the consensus of the coalition. That, necessarily what one particular foreign minister or defense minister has to say. So I think Israel is going to kind of stay within the bounds of traditional Israeli foreign policy and will be a strong partner for the United States and a strong force for stability in the region. There's nothing that leads me to believe that the outcome of the election is going to change that. What particular policies the government might choose, I just don't know.
How does the relationship, this deal with Iran radiates around the globe, the business interests that the Iranians have with Europe, as well as Russia, goes in both directions? And how should that, what's going on now, inform President Trump's approach to both our European allies and our Russian adversary?
Well, I think it really puts the Europeans in a hard place. I mean, obviously, the Iranians are at the root of this. To me, it is inconceivable how any responsible European government could be talking about engagement or relief for Iran at this point. I mean, I think the whole $15 billion line of credit thing, that's got to be dead. That's ridiculous. That Iran is behind the attack on another country that endangers the world's global oil supply, and the European response to that is to just write a check to the Iranians for $15 billion. That makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I think that's an understatement. He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of books including Wiki at War and Private Sector Public Wars. Jim, thanks for joining us as always. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
Playing Cars all morning in honor of passing of Rick Ocasek. All right, this video has emerged. Representative Ilhan Omar, she and Nancy Pelosi visited Ghana in the last, it was about 6 weeks ago.
Oh, during their summer break.
Visiting dungeons in Ghana that were used during the slave trade 400 years ago. And Ilhan Omar, as she was experiencing those dungeons, walking through those dungeons, called to mind other things happening in the world today, according to her.
We arrived in Ghana, and one of the first things we did was to visit what some would say is a castle, but they were dungeons. And I remember as we arrived, one of the guides led us into the female dungeon. And he started giving us a description of what used to take place as the Africans were being kept, were held there as captives. And every time he gave a description, I'd had this sort of flashback to an image that I saw on TV in Libya, where you had Africans in a small room that were now captives. And that image was from today. And every time he would talk about the separation of the kids and from their parents, and how they would have young girls be in the same dungeons as the women, or they would have young boys be in the same dungeons as the men. I couldn't stop seeing images of the current camps we have here at our borders in the United States.
What?
So the slave trade in Ghana from 400 years ago is the Libyan slave trade going on in that warlordocracy, is the border facilities in America. That's Representative Ilhan Omar, Brotherly Love Spice. She was on Face the Nation this weekend, not asked about the FEC complaint Not asked that's been filed against her and her
not
campaign.
Not asked about her love life because I just watched the whole interview.
Not asked about that either.
Homewrecker.
But she was asked about those comments you just heard, and here's her response. Of course.
Oh, is she taken out of context, Dan?
Of course she wasn't being critical of Customs and Border Protection. Aww. Of course she wasn't attacking U.S. law enforcement. Of course not.
The Republican National Committee has released a video of you, and it, I want to read you just some of it. You're comparing migrant shelters to dungeons used about 400 years ago in Ghana that you recently visited, and you toured those caves in Ghana recently. It's getting a lot of attention. Did you mean, when you were talking there, to compare U.S. border agents to slave traders?
So I'm only controversial because people seem to want to controversy. Oh, right. What I talked about at our panel that was the plight of Black immigrants was about the experience I was having as I went through the dungeons. There were stories that were being told, and I talked about how at that moment I had an image of what's happening in Libya. Mm-hmm. As people as are being sold. We've all seen that video, that auction of somebody being sold for $400. And then I talked about the separation stories that he told about how families were being torn apart, how children were being separated from their parents, how husband and wife would be forcibly separated. And I said that kind of reminded me of what was happening at our border here.
But you didn't mean it as an attack on U.S. border agents.
Absolutely not.
No, of course not. Don't be ridiculous. It was reminiscent of what we're doing here, what the slave traders did in Ghana 400 years ago. But I'm obviously not comparing our border agents to Ghanaian slave traders from 400 years ago, even though I'm suggesting their conduct is the same. Okay. That's one of the faces of your modern Democrat Socialist Party. That's one of the people in charge of that Democrat Socialist Party.
And then she responded to the son of the 9/11 victim who called into our show, criticizing him during Ground Zero, saying, you know, it hurt me as an American, but she was also discriminated against because she's a Muslim, and it was difficult for her.
After 9/11.
Yeah, after 9/11. Yes. Okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Head voices on.
Thank goodness Eddie Pinheiro and that defense. Bears eke out a victory in Denver yesterday, of course. Wild last minute.
That 53-yard field goal, pretty good.
All the questions coming into the season were about the kicker. All the questions two games in are about the quarterback. Speaking of which,
we need a new one.
Please, I had the opportunity to play golf with Mike Tomczak this summer.
Big shooter, are you?
I mean, as you know, world-class athletes just sort of hang out with one another.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we come across one another. So right. Just, you know.
Weren't you scheduled to golf with Mitch Trubisky, too?
I was. That got canceled.
Oh.
Thank God, no. Jeez.
No, maybe you could
wonder
have given
why that
him.
Trubisky stink on me.
You could have given him a few tips.
No, he's supposed to be a great guy, too, so I'm rooting for him. But it's been a struggle the first two games. By the way, Denver is not a good team.
Yeah, you think?
Even though it's always tough on the road, I know. But for more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by former Bears quarterback, and he's still in football. We'll get to that. Mike Tomczak. Mike, thanks so much for being with us. Appreciate it. Do we have Mike? There we go. Mike?
Yeah. Yes, hey. I'm here.
Okay, great. Thanks for being with us.
Hey, good morning to you both. You're welcome. You're welcome, Dan.
And we recall, too, when I mentioned on air that I played golf with you, that you had previously played golf with my partner over here, Amy, and you gave her some tips on how to hit the ball.
Yeah, you told me to keep my left eye on the ball during my swing, and that helped. Remember, I parred that hole?
You parred that hole.
Sure.
It's good to have both eyes in it, too, but your eye is closest to the ball is the most important, from what Jack Nicklaus told me.
Yes.
So I'm just carrying on. Yeah, it's carrying on that fabric.
There you
Thank
go.
Thank you. So maybe you could help Dan.
It's almost like I play golf with Jack Nicklaus because I play golf with Mike Tomczak.
Exactly.
No.
And he can play, by the way. Tomczak is a good golfer, too.
So basically, you're calling me because you say the Bears need another quarterback?
Yeah.
Are
you ready to come in? Are you ready to put the jersey back on?
Suit up.
I'd be good in the backyard. Anyone has backyard family reunions, I'm available.
Well, do you think we're being too hard on Trubisky, that we should give him some more chances to redeem himself here?
I haven't listened to what you've been talking about because I live in a different state, but you know, quarterbacks are always the centerpiece of any Monday morning, you know, good and bad. Obviously, Trubisky had a strong resume coming into this season, you know, with that 12-4 record last year. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of moving parts. There's a lot of different things. The team takes on new chemistry. I don't think the line is playing any particularly well. That's the first thing I look at is the rushing yards. And they did a terrible job in their opener against Green Bay. They did a terrible job yesterday running the football. So, you know, that puts a lot of pressure on the quarterback when it comes to 3rd and 8 and 3rd and 15. And not many people can convert that on a consistent basis.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's a lot of focus on Trubisky, but what kind of protection is he getting? And also the indication of the run game. That's fair. And so if the line is not performing up to snuff, and that's an issue that has to be solved in and of itself, but does that mean that Nagy has to think about getting Trubisky out of the pocket, letting him use his athletic ability a little bit more and trying to, and maybe not trying to sort of constrain him so he doesn't make mistakes as much?
You know, I don't know what's talked about in those meeting rooms with the quarterbacks and also the head coach. You know, they have a pretty good relationship, it seems like. And it's not a grab bag offense. You know, I've been around offenses that the coach just reaches into that brown paper bag and pulls out a piece of paper and says, okay, run this play. I mean, you know, Amy and Dan, this is well choreographed. They practice. They go over these things that are the best plays for them to run in certain situations. And the bottom line, it comes execution. And if the quarterback's not getting protected, by all means, get his butt out of the pocket, you know, through – you know, dashes out of the pocket or design rollouts and things of that nature. So there's smarter men in that building up at Hallis Hall that could probably figure it out, but that was an ugly win. That's a win right there. As much emotion that was put into that game, it'll pay dividends because it's so hard to win in the National Football League, and it took us, what, to the last 2 seconds yesterday, which was pretty dynamic.
Yeah, how much of that really is a momentum, that momentum carry you on to the next week or weeks when you win a game that looked lost there until the last 30 seconds?
Yeah, you're only as good as your last broadcast, right, for you and Amy? I mean, you have listeners tuning in every minute, every second. So, you know, there's pressure on you to continue that consistency and that motivation and that momentum. The word momentum is tremendous in a locker room. You know, all the fun that the Bears had last year after their victories and their victory dances became such a, you know, normal thing for them. The routine was to show up Monday with a victory. And the early part of the season, I'm sure we have them under a microscope too much. But I just know from my experience, no matter how you win by one or you win by 30, it's a tremendous boost for that course of the week when it comes to preparation for the next opponent.
Speaking of winning by 30, well, actually 40, the New England Patriots blanked the Dolphins, and Antonio Brown was in tow. Terry Bradshaw, who, of course, you know well, Steelers Nation there, he broke bad on Antonio Brown, saying that he was glad the Steelers got rid of him. I'm upset now that I know how he got away, what he was doing there. I wish they would have gotten rid of him a long time ago. I had no idea the Steelers, catered to Brown as much as they supposedly did. I can't stand players like Antonio Brown saying that if Antonio Brown had been on his team and the management wouldn't have done something about it, he just wouldn't have thrown to him. That's how much he doesn't like players like Antonio Brown. I wonder how you react to the Antonio Brown saga and you know, players, prima donnas like Antonio Brown, at least in Terry Bradshaw's eyes.
Well, with all due respect, Dan, it's probably not even worth my time to comment on it. Enough's been said. Everyone has their own opinions. I like to talk about more positive things, players that love the game, players that are passionate about it, and players that believe in the whole team concept.
And who's
that? Who are some players that you admire?
Oh, in my locker room, my rookie year, I mean, you know, Jay Hilgenberg, Matt Sui, Gary Fensick, Jim McMahon, Mike Singleton. Otis Wilson, Steve McMichael, Dan Hampton, Emory Moorhead, Richard Dent, Mike Ditka. You know, back in the day, and I hate to go back, you know, 36 years since we won the Super Bowl, The players policed the locker room. If any player became bigger than the team, you know, there were words that were exchanged that brought him back in. And after we won the Super Bowl, some guys felt a little greedy, including myself. But, you know, Dick always said, guys, I'm going to make you accountable, I'm going to make you dependable, and I'm going to make you a team player. And that's what you all see in New England. And you've seen it in championship ball clubs year after year. The championship teams always have the best nucleus of team players. And you see people kind of get out of their element and they start branding themselves. And I've never seen more professional athletes brand themselves, A, from a tattoo standpoint, and B, from an endorsement standpoint. So, you know, those are two things that's really changed in the National Football League or in professional sports as a whole.
I want to get your take on that, too. Organizations. So you were with the Steelers. That's an organization that's and I'm a big Steelers fan. But that's an organization, no matter what's happening, they're almost in the hunt every year. Sort of like the St. Louis Cardinals in baseball. No matter what's mm-hmm. happening, you know, they don't have to be a big market. They don't have to have the most expensive players. They always seem to be right there, competing for division, competing for playoffs, in the playoffs, competing for a championship. Can you give us a sense of what you think some of the ingredients are that make organizations, even beyond the team, so good year in and year out, like the Steelers and Cardinals?
You know, if I had that magic potion, those magic words, or even that mantra, you know, I think all 32 teams would be the highest bidders.
Yeah, right.
Right? So everyone's trying to, you know, be the best. And how do you become the best? You study what the teams that have had success so year after year. And people talk about effort. People talk about, you know, showing up and being accountable. But until you do it as a group, you know, you're going to have some struggles along the way. And the biggest thing that gets in the way, you know, just speaking from experience, is greed. You know, I want more money. I want more, you know, touches with the football. I want to be on the field more. I want this. It's all about I instead of us. What can I do? What can I do better? So I think, you know, look from an organizational standpoint, you know, people talk about the McCaskies being conservative and they're not doing this. Well, they've gone overboard with their facilities. They've given a tremendous culture environment that show the athletes that truly care about not only that, you know, what they're doing here when they're under contract, but when they're doing post-career and everything. So they're taking an extreme active role in the players nowadays. And I just think that that consistency has to start with inside the locker room. It has to start with inside the locker room. You know, they try to weed out some people that possibly could be that, you know, that so-called virus in the locker room. Mm-hmm. But it's hard. We're dealing with human beings, people, that make an awful lot of money. And the bottom line is you got to win football games, you know, to gain that credibility year after year. And I think every person that owns a National Football League team realizes that. But it's so hard to win. You saw some of those games. You probably thought the Bears were done.
After the 2-point conversion,
no
I did. Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
You know, and here in Pittsburgh, you know, the Steelers are 0-2. Well, teams that are 0-2 at this stage of the season have a 28% chance of getting in the playoffs. Okay, so there's consequences that go along with losing, and you guys probably have the rest of your show to talk about all this, but by and large, it starts in the locker room, and it builds outwardly, and you build layers of trusted, dependable, reliable individuals that can get the job done. Right. And there's so much turnover as well. You know, you got new free agents, and you got new draft choices coming in, and if you don't have a strong seniority in your locker room, sometimes, you know, things get lost in translation.
So, Mike Tomczak, what are you up to these days?
Well, currently I'm in an industrial maintenance shop right here in Albella, Pennsylvania. I'm selling I have a business that sells industrial maintenance products. Mm-hmm. So I'm visiting some customers down in this beautiful part of the country. And in the afternoons, I coach football at Youngstown State University. Good. And if I have any time left over, I'll pop in my foundation that I started in Youngstown to assist with intellectually and developmental disabilities for young autistic individuals.
That's
so
great.
Staying active, great. Amy. Staying active. Yep. Yeah, it's one of those I wish I had 25 hours in a day instead of 24.
Right, so you can play a little bit more golf, too. Exactly.
Yeah, oh, what... I tell you what, I'm actually going to play golf here, Dan. I say that there's a big charity called Folds of Honor.
Yeah, sure.
That raises scholarships for military kids that have lost parents. And it's a big fundraiser here that we take part in with our foundation contributing. So it was pretty special. We had some country singers last night at the club singing, and then today we got a golf tournament later on after I get my work done.
He is former Bears quarterback Mike Tomczak. Mike, thanks so much for joining us. I look forward to teeing up with you again when you're in Chicago next.
Amy and Dan, I appreciate it. And you know, it's always great to talk about the Bears victories on a Monday morning.
Yep.
It is.
Makes the drive into work.
Yeah, it makes the week easier, too.
Especially exciting ones.
Yeah,
yes, especially exciting ones.
I mean, there's so much. They're serious. We don't have enough beef jerky to chew on to talk about the Bears, right?
Thanks so much, Mike. Appreciate it.
I wish you all well.
Take care.
God bless. Bye-bye.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Oh, this is is this a car song?
Yeah, Moving in Stereo. I love this song.
This song is wretched.
Benjamin Oregon. No, it's a good
oh, my
song.
Gosh, it's horrible.
It's not as good as Drive. That's their best song, but... Anyway, rest in peace, Rick Ocasek. Would you like to not live in space? Just visit a hotel in space. The Gateway Foundation plans to build a rotating space station that will produce varying rates of artificial gravity, utilizing technology from the International Space Station. The accommodations are geared toward guests who want to experience life in space, but in the luxury and comfort of a hotel. That's ideal for me. Activities on board, including low-gravity basketball.
Basketball.
Yeah, so you could feel
Sign
like you're Jordan
up.
For a little while. Low gravity trampolining, rock climbing. Yeah.
Are they pet friendly, Dan?
The Von Braun Space Station will feature privately owned modules used for villas, hotels, or commercial activity, as well as government owned modules used for research. According to this proposal, that they expect to be fully operational by 2025 with 100 tourists visiting weekly. All right. The truth is out there. And so is low-gravity basketball.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Just remarkable this weekend. This allegation against Brett Kavanaugh comes out in a New York Times story previewing a book on Kavanaugh that is released tomorrow by two New York Times reporters, both fellow travelers on the left, as will come as no surprise.
Yeah, they're taking off their normal duties to write this much-needed book. Of bull jive, I think, but okay.
The story is this. A classmate of Kavanaugh's, Max Steyer, allegedly saw Kavanaugh with his pants down at another drunken dorm party that's separate and distinct from the other allegations that were presented during his confirmation saga, where friends pushed his genitalia into the hand of a female student. That's the story. What the New York Times didn't report in the story initially, but had to provide in an editor's note after the fact, is this. The book reports that the female student in question declined to be interviewed, and friends say that she does not recall the incident. That information has been added to the article. So you have an uncorroborated story that the alleged victim can't remember, uncorroborated by the alleged victim as well. And despite that, you had many of the Democrat Socialist candidates for president running around on the Sunday talk shows calling for the impeachment of Kavanaugh, as well as members of Congress like our very own Sean Casten here in the suburbs suggesting the same. Molly Hemingway and her co-author Carrie Severino, co-author of the book Justice on Trial about the Kavanaugh proceeding, was on with Tom Bevin, Real Clear Politics. Here's Molly Hemingway sort of summarizing this latest event.
Yes, so there is this book coming out on Tuesday. It's written by two reporters who were actually kind of involved in anti-Kavanaugh efforts, is probably the best way to put it. They were reporting on it for the New York Times. They were pulled off of their beats to help because they both had backgrounds, privileged backgrounds, where they had intersected with people who were in the story. And Robin Pogorbin went to Yale with Kavanaugh. She actually roomed with one of the central figures who coordinated anti-Kavanaugh efforts. She lightly discloses that in her book. And now they're out with a book, and Carrie and I have been reading it. I just finished it. And they also have an essay where they claim that there was another allegation. Left out of the essay is that the claim that was made is actually denied by the alleged victim. They put that in their book, but they didn't put that in their essay, which is causing some people to question their journalistic ethics.
Oh, gee. Jonathan Lamar, who is the White House reporter for AP, tweets it out, the excerpt I just read you, minus that editor's note correction. He tweeted out over the weekend, "This feels noteworthy." Well, does the editor's note feel noteworthy too now?
I mean, don't let the facts get in the way of a good story, really.
The remarkable lack of interest in anything resembling the ethos of due process when it comes to political opponents, as far as the left is concerned. And this, another glaring case of it. For more on this topic and a few others, we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Michael Barone, senior political analyst for the Washington Examiner, WashingtonExaminer.com, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, the longtime co-author of the Almanac of American Politics. Michael, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, it's nice to be with you.
What's your take on the this Kavanaugh imbroglio over the weekend? And I mean, really, truly, the calls for impeachment, reopen the investigation and move for articles of impeachment on Justice Kavanaugh at the same time we're doing it for President Trump.
I think it's sort of preposterous, and the New York Times is becoming a laughingstock. I mean, the pretensions it has had historically to being a paper of record and all the news that's fit to print are, you know, totally anachronistic. And in fact, it's a propaganda organ and not a very good one.
And that's the fact that
they had to add this point in the article that, major witness of this sort of thing doesn't remember it. There's no evidence from her that she remembers any of this.
And regarding the New York Times, even Andrew Sullivan, Breaking Bad in New York Magazine and New York Times, saying that they've abandoned liberalism and now they're just practicing straight activism.
Well, I think that's true. I mean, you had this kind of extraordinary statement in this meeting of editors and staffers, transcripts of which predictably leaked out from Dean Baquet, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, the executive editor of the New York Times, is that, we ran the Russia collusion stories up the flagpole, and eventually nobody, you know, Bob Mueller came along and deflated it entirely. And so now we're going to run racism. And, you know, they've got this project, 1619. Racism is basically the totally shaping factor in American history, down to the location of the freeways in Atlanta. The fact is they're leaving out a whole bunch of things when they talk about racism or the race issue or slavery or segregation. Important parts of American history, not the only important parts of American history. So it's become advocates. And the basic idea is that you slam anybody who supports Trump as a racist, and, their comments are and concerns are out of bounds. And it's hit the second coming of Hitler. These people are whipping themselves into a frenzy, and they seem to be doing, in my view, a much better job of defeating their cause than Donald Trump, for all his tweets, has done in defeating his.
Yeah, I think this is going to help Trump in 2020, that's for sure. But President Trump also tweeted over the weekend that Brett Kavanaugh should start suing people for libel, or the Justice Department should come to his rescue. What do you think about that?
This second. I mean, Donald Trump is somebody who has had many negative stories about him long before he started running for president, came down that escalator. Has had a fixation on the idea that public figures should be able to sue. I think you can make an argument against the leading Supreme Court case on this New York Times v. Sullivan, 1964. Well, it's an old saying in the law, hard cases make bad law. Hard cases, you know, the Alabama Supreme Court in that case committed a real terrible decision, and the Supreme Court said we're going to get rid of this and basically say public figures don't have a right to sue. I have often wondered whether the corollary of that is that anybody that the press writes about is that by definition a public figure and nobody can sue. We have some people that can sue who are not public figures, and we'll see how that goes. But, I mean, you know, the Supreme Court justice is not going to sue these people. I think that's ridiculous.
No, of course not. I think he's just making the point. I think that it's libelous and defamatory what Brett Kavanaugh has been subjected to. But I agree with you. I wanted to get to this piece that you wrote in the Washington Examiner, which I really enjoyed. Just providing, and this is why I enjoy your work, providing some historical context for people who believe history just started 5 minutes ago. This piece about the Trump era. And it not being nearly as extraordinary as everybody suggests it is in terms of, you know, some of the bizarre aspects of it, some of the different ways of communicating and so forth. And you provide a little bit of historical context.
Well, I've been reading a lot of history all my life. I've written a little bit of history. I got a book coming out in October called How America's Political Parties Change and How They Don't. And one of the points I make, our political parties have been around for 187 and 165 years. That's a long time. They've adapted to the times in various ways. And they have sometimes, committed the sins or the acts that Trump detractors find so unsettling in him. They say that Trump is doing trade policy by tweet. Well, Franklin Roosevelt, who, by my judgment, and I think most historians, is a great president in many ways, sat in bed and determined the price of gold day by day on the basis of whim. One day he thought, let's go 21 cents up because that's 3 times 7 and it's a lucky number.
Oh, my gosh.
He was a great war leader. He picked great people, but he also did some unsettling things. And, it's a mixed bag. He wasn't Hitler. He was one of the people that first spotted that Hitler was a bad guy and that tried to get America and successfully got America in to fight Hitler and defeat Hitler and destroy Hitler. Donald Trump isn't Hitler either. And all these concern about this stuff and so forth, I think, is a little bit wacko.
Yeah.
So if Twitter was around back then, he'd be tweeting, right?
Perhaps.
Well, Would
FDR have tweeted? There's a book title for you. Yeah.
Well, he did find the fireside chats.
Exactly.
The radio,
yeah.
Formal talks. He adapted to the time. They were very effective. He didn't use it very often. Not nearly as often as Trump tweets. There were only something like 17 fireside chats in 12 years of his presidency. But he used it very competently. And you go back and read one of the scandals, gosh, how today's liberals would have handled this, I just don't know. But on D-Day, President Roosevelt had a fireside chat, and he was on all the radio stations or networks around the country. And he came on, and he talked about D-Day, and the entirety of his talk was a prayer.
Protect
our sons and so forth. Mm-hmm. It's a non-sectarian prayer. It's a beautiful prayer. And it's... if a president came on the radio or the television, tweeted a prayer nowadays, we'd be hearing about how, that we're going to have people burned at the stake by Torquemada or something next week. And, the hysteria about Donald Trump, coming from his detractors and some of his supporters from time to time, needs to be put into a little bit of perspective, I think.
Yeah, and also, I mean, the other aspects to making threats or suggestions that you don't follow through on to sort of either trial balloon or try and get leverage for something else that you want. That's not new. Having some picks in senior level positions, including the cabinet, that turn out to be duds, having, you know, some personnel turnover. That's not new, yeah. Right? I mean, these are things that have happened before.
Roosevelt had three vice presidents.
There you go for turnover. Yeah.
There was a real turnover there. And he was kind of a chaotic administrator. People complained about that and so forth. The results are there. We got out of the Depression eventually. We can argue about that, and we won the war.
He is Michael Barone, senior political analyst for the Washington Examiner, resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, longtime co-author of The Almanac of American Politics. And you heard he's got a book coming out in October, so look for that. Michael, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for being with me. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, always a pleasure. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Yeah, rest in peace, Eddie Money, another rock great. Eddie Money, Rick Ocasek. Boy, it must make you feel a little bit old, Amy.
You know, it does, Dan.
Yeah.
Because I used to watch Cars videos on MTV. I'm sure you did, too.
I did, too, but I was a toddler.
Oh, yeah, you're a baby.
All right, you've got to temper our expectations about the reckoning that may come for the senior level leadership of the FBI during the 2016 election. And, of course, anybody else then by extension. Trey Gowdy was on with Sean Hannity over the weekend talking about the forthcoming Department of Justice's Inspector General report on FISA application, the Steele dossier, sort of everything in that space. It's been sent to DOJ. The IG report has been sent to DOJ for classification review. So what should we expect? You want McCabe to be prosecuted. You want other people to be prosecuted criminally. Might be that we're not going to get that. And Trey Gowdy makes that point. You know, it's like sort of like the Felicity Huffman thing. 14 days in jail may not be satisfying to you. $30,000 may not be satisfying, but it is still a rebuke and it shouldn't go unnoticed. Trey Gowdy making that point to Hannity.
If they go forward with McCabe, you can rest assured that's going to be a tough trial. We don't want the United States government going to trial and losing on a regular basis. They lost to Greg Craig. That's not good. So if you're going to go to trial, you need to win.
Now, to me, that seems like premeditated fraud on a FISA court. And when you couple that with Andrew McCabe, the deputy FBI director, saying, well, no dossier, no FISA warrant, that makes me think they didn't care about what they were presenting to the court. And that was a fraud. And they knew it was a fraud, but they said it was verified and it wasn't.
Let's assume for the sake of argument that everything you said was true. Let's just assume that. You still have to find a criminal statute if your objective is indictment, which is why I'm really clear every time y'all are good enough to have me on. We cannot live in a society where indictment is the only thing that carries with it any stigma. I mean, most of the names involved with the FISA approval process in 2016 have either been fired or they've been publicly called to task. Keep in mind, Jim Comey twice now, the inspector general, had said you did not meet our expectations. You failed to file a policy. You violated your employment agreement. All of that has to be significant. Look, I used to make representations in front of a court, and I tried really hard to be honest and fair about it. But let's assume that I didn't tell the court something. The remedy for me is not indictment. The remedy is I may lose my law license.
Well,
the remedy is the court may hold me in contempt.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, even losing law licenses would be a good start, starting with Comey. But Gowdy point makes an important point here. There is shame, or there should be shame, associated with the professional reviews, not just the criminal reviews. And yes, it's annoying when McCabe gets the CNN contributor gig after lying before Congress, and there's seemingly two standards of justice depending on who your friends are. I get it. It's more than annoying. It's it's undermining the credibility and legitimacy of our justice system. But the point that he makes about the reckoning, don't let the fact that they've got some friends in the media who pick up for them and lionize them the way that Comey has been lionized, and he gets a big book deal and so on and so forth. Same thing with McCabe. They were not exonerated. They were not reviewed well by professionals in their space. We know what they did, and there's something to take away from that, and probably more will continue to trickle out. Hopefully the Trump administration continues to be as transparent as is legally possible with respect to all of this. But I thought it's just the Trey Gowdy's been so good on this because he provides a broader perspective. And also just restrain yourself, exercise some restraint here and some appreciation for what we already know to be true and for the reviews that are already in.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2 on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I'm looking forward to the rock opera or musical, the Joe Biden corn pop story. Joe Biden talking in 2017 at the dedication of the pool in Wilmington, Delaware, where he used a lifeguard, about one altercation, one incident that, was exemplary of his heroism back in the day on the mean streets of Wilmington, Delaware.
He's not going to take you-know-what from anybody.
This was the diving board area, and I was one of the guards, and there weren't a lot of, there was a three-meter board. And you fell off sideways, you landed on the damn, the darn cement over there. And Corn Pop was a bad dude. Bad. And he ran a bunch of bad boys.
Bad boy.
And
you're
I
a bad
did.
Boy.
And back in those Corn days, Pop. You see how things have changed?
Yeah.
One of the things you had to use, if you used pomade in your hair, you had to wear a bathing cap. And so he was up on the board, wouldn't listen to me. I said, hey, Esther, you, off the board, or I'll come up and drag you off. Well, he came off. And he said, I'll meet you outside. My car, this was mostly, these were all public housing behind it. My car, there was a gate out here. I parked my car outside the gate. And he said, I'll be waiting for you. He was waiting for three guys in straight razors. Not a joke. There was a guy named Bill Wright, Mouse, the only white guy, and he did all the pools. He was the mechanic. And I said, what am I going to do? He said, come down here in the basement. Where mechanics, where all the pool filter is. You know, the chain, there used to be a chain that went across the deep end. And he cut off a 6-foot length of chain. He folded up, he said, you walk out with that chain. And you walk to the car and say, you may cut me, man, but I'm going to wrap this chain around your head. I said, you kidding me?
Yeah, do you want to know how it ended, Dan? Do you want to know?
So I walked out with the chain. And I walked up to my car, and they had, in those days, you used to remember the straight razors, you'd bang them on the curb, get them rusty, put them in a rain barrel, get them rusty.
No, I don't.
And I looked at them.
Nobody else
But I
either.
Was smart then. I said, first of all, I said, when I tell you get off the board, you get off the board, and I'll kick you out again. But I shouldn't have called you, Esther Williams. I apologize for that. I apologize, but I didn't know that apology was going to work. He said, you apologize to me? I said, I apologize for that, not for throwing you out, but I apologize for what I said. He said, okay, close the straight razor, and my heart began to beat again.
Oh, thank goodness. Oh, thank goodness it ended.
Who do you think should play Corn Pop in the rock opera that memorializes this wonderful story? By the way, text from 847.
Best text ever.
What he didn't mention is that Joe Biden's street name was Grape Nuts.
Corn Pop would only be better if his nickname or street name was Sugar Smacks or Fruit Loops.
The New York Times is reporting that three gentlemen named Snap, Crackle, and Pop are ready to corroborate Joe Biden's story. All right. For more jokes at Joe Biden's expense, we're pleased to be joined by Ed Morrissey, senior editor for HotAir.com, columnist for the week. Ed, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, I appreciate it. Can I tell you a quick story about my childhood?
Yes, please do. And, one stipulation.
Yeah.
You have to turn out to be the hero.
Well, here's the thing.
I was in a gang fight with Captain Crunch and Count Chocula.
Yeah.
And I just barely managed to get out of it by throwing milk all over them. They got soggy, and I was able to beat them to a pulp. It was amazing.
A lot of people don't know this, but Count Chocula, he's a bad boy. He's a very
bad boy.
He's naughty. He's a naughty boy. Yeah. I'm serious.
Captain Crunch used to have those whistles, though. Don't you remember Captain Crunch used to have those whistles?
Yeah. What about the frog from Sugar Smacks? What about the toucan from Fruit Loops? Where does he come in?
He flew off. So I didn't have to worry about him.
So this is the leading candidate for the Democrat nomination for president.
Well, here's the craziest part about this. Apparently, there was actually a corn pop. I don't know if you caught this yesterday, but somebody actually dug up an obituary for a guy who was actually corn pop, and he was the gang leader for the Romans. So as crazy as this story sounds and as crazy as Joe Biden actually is, this particular story might be true. Now, why he's still telling it 50 years later is beyond any comprehension whatsoever. But apparently this guy actually did exist.
Now, do you know if he had a grandson named T-Bone in New Jersey?
They're still working on T-Bone in New Jersey. Or, for that matter, Pookie. Remember Pookie with Barack Obama?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Cousin Pookie?
Yeah. Sure. Of course. The state of play in the presidential race with Joe Biden, he managed to not injure himself on Thursday night, so he won the debate. And Elizabeth Warren seemed to be... believe she's sitting on a lead that I don't really think she's sitting on. My sense is, Joe Biden is very fragile politically. But until and unless somebody can break into the African-American vote, the lead in the African-American vote that Biden has, they've got a real problem stopping him.
Oh, I think you're absolutely correct about that. And I think Elizabeth Warren was playing it very smart during the debate. There were other people on stage that were attacking Joe Biden, and she heroically did not jump in front of Joe Biden to protect him from that in the way that Tulsi Gabbard did, for instance, in the second debate. I think that if she goes on the attack against Joe Biden, it's going to make her look mean and nasty, and she already kind of has that reputation anyway. And so she's hanging back and letting other people do the dirty work and staying above the fray, which is probably for a number two person on this and the clear option, because Bernie Sanders isn't an option, if Biden stumbles, yeah, it's probably a smart strategy. It may not be the most, may not be the most courageous strategy, but it's probably a smart strategy.
Now, what Julian Castro went after Biden for his age, pretty much saying, you don't remember what you just said. Do you think he'll be... even if the numbers are there, invited back? Or do you think they'll pull a Tulsi Gabbard on him, meaning the DNC, and not have him participate in the next debate?
Well, they've already got the criteria down for the next debate, and I think he's already qualified for it. So that would be tough for the DNC to do. But I think after the October debate, they're going to have to tighten this thing up pretty dramatically and try to cut it down to just three or four candidates on stage, because there's only three candidates that are pulling into double digits on a fairly consistent basis. And so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to drag everybody else along with them all the way down to Iowa. So my guess is that at some point they're going to start tightening this up to 5% or 6% or 7% and lop off the deadwood.
I want to talk about the story that's out of Illinois here, Will County, and also Indiana. And that's this deceased abortionist named Klopfer, who upon search of his residence, it was discovered 2,246 medically preserved fetus remains. Will County government confirming these details. He was known to practice his trade at clinics in Fort Wayne, South Bend, and Gary. Let's focus on the one in South Bend, because it turns out that Mannequin Pete, who's one of the candidates that's still allowed in these debates as well, great defender of those clinics and, by extension, the abortionists, including this guy who had his license revoked a couple of years ago.
You know, this whole thing is very, very disturbing. And what's more disturbing is that outside of the local news, it's not getting hardly any coverage at all, no. Except on, you know, conservative websites like Hot Air and WIND, you know, that's covering this story. There's almost no coverage of this. And this is somebody who's keeping 2,200 fetal remains apparently as trophies in a backwoods property that this guy had. He was clearly not doing scientific research that would have, even if there was any such scientific research that was justified, this is not what was going on. He was keeping these things as his personal property, which is, you know, just at first blush is just gross. And then, secondly, it reminds me a lot of the Kermit Gosnell case, yes. Where Gosnell was keeping the feet of the babies that he had aborted as trophies. And he had these things all over the place in his clinic. The only difference here, it appears, is this guy was smart enough not to keep them actually in the clinic, but to have them at some remote property that he owned in an unincorporated area of Indiana.
Well, it was in Illinois, but and also too.
Oh, yeah, Illinois. Sorry, you're right, Illinois.
Yeah, well, you should know too that he also rented a garage space from a female. I don't know if it's neighbor or friend. And in that garage, they found about 120 more fetuses. So what happened? The family called a junk, you know, because he had hoarded stuff in the house, and when he died, they wanted to clean it out. And after 2 days of them removing debris and junk, I mean, because there was junk in his house. That's when they found the babies or the fetuses, and they called the family, and the family immediately called the police. So the medical examiner is going to be overwhelmed when 2,249 said fetuses come in today to his clinic, because they're going to have to go through all of that and to determine if any of the babies were killed after, you know, if they were killed after they were delivered.
Right. In the same way that Gosnell did. And
yes.
Gosnell, by the way, had the same issue with his house and his properties.
Right.
They were overrun basically by junk all over the place, and the parallels here are starting to become very, very spooky here between Klopfer and Gosnell.
We also have the other parallel because this is nationwide, generally speaking, thanks to the political power of Planned Parenthood and people that support those ghouls and their ghoulish business. Unregulated. There's only two things that the left wants completely unregulated to the point of lawlessness in this country: abortion mills and America's borders. And on the former, you have stories out that his staff, much like Gosnell's, was not trained properly, not trained on medicating
right.
women. And so here we go again in terms of that comparison. But what we're going to hear, I suspect, from Manick and Pete and Planned Parenthood, just like we did with Gosnell, we're just as upset as you are, but this is a one-off, and nothing like this should happen, but we also don't want our clinics subjected to the same regulations as any other medical facility, and of course we want to continue the tax dollars flowing, and of course we want abortion on demand right up until birth, as you have in Illinois and New York, and it's desired with KKK Northam in Virginia. That's what I suspect we're going to hear, but I'd still like to put that biblical scholar from South Bend on point and have him respond to this.
Right, right. I mean, he was the one who said that it was life occurs at breath.
Yes.
And he based it on the Bible. And I would like to hear how this guy was able to operate for so long in South Bend without being caught, until finally in 2014 they stripped him of his license after years and years and years of complaints about his practice. And another point about Gosnell was apparently there was a two-tiered system for pain management. If you were under 16 or you had money, you got pain meds. If you were over 16 and didn't have money, you didn't get pain meds. I mean, there was all sorts of different allegations that were going on with this clinic when they finally shut him down in 2014. And this guy was unrepentant to the very end. He had said all along, if he got his license back, he'd start doing the same thing all over again.
Yeah, you legitimize a ghoulish business and you get ghouls.
Yep.
No surprise. Ed Morrissey, senior editor for HotAir.com, columnist for the week. And he's got a column on this topic, I should say, at HotAir.com. Ed, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
He joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
We didn't get a chance to talk about it this morning, but this UAW strike, rank and file UAW members, help me with this. The former assistant to your union president has been charged with embezzling union funds. There's a federal criminal investigation into your current president and his former one, and you're taking career cues from these guys with respect to your money. Okay,
sure. I'd rethink that, guys.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.